Blog Talk Radio.
Started with hanging posters on my bedroom wall. The battle rapping for status up in the school hall. Just call me Double Sushi, thought I was too raw. And hip hop was my home, I had my shoes off. 6'3 in high school, skip a hoop dream. If I don't blow up, then maybe I'll try the school thing. I went to college to do my family a favor, but I couldn't pick a major cause I wanted to be major. I tried selling work, but it didn't work. So I worked, chopping center clerk, finna go berserk. Lunch break, see me writing 16s over Mickey D's. Skipping class, making beats over 60 keys. And I love it even though I'm just chasing. Selfish ambition, couldn't tell your boy Nathan. Watch out all you rappers cause they finna let Cray in. But I was sleeping on the sun like the day's in. And you can have the money, and you can have the fame. For me, I want the glory, I'm living for the name. See, life is just a picture, I see outside the frame. I'm living for a kingdom, and I ain't never seen. Yeah, and I'ma chase that, I'ma chase that. Found a key to life, and let's believe that I'ma play that. Glory, I'ma chase that, I'ma chase that. Glory, I'ma chase that, I'ma chase that.
Good afternoon. We want to welcome you all to today's broadcast of Diversity in College Tennis. This is the UR Tennis Network, and we're very excited to have you listening in today. On today's program, we have Coach John Whitlinger. He is the head men's coach at Stanford University. I'm very excited to talk to this gentleman. I have some prior experience with him, and look forward to getting him on the air here today and talking about this diversity in college tennis issue. Those of you that are joining us for the first time, my name is Jason Haynes. I am a former collegiate coach of 20 years of experience. I spent most of my time at the community college level and also served in the Division I level as well. I spent my time at Tyler Junior College, Lee College, and Southwest Texas State University here in San Marcos, Texas. We were national champions at Lee College 3 separate times. That would have been 2002, 2007, 2009. I was the ITA Wilson Coach of the Year in 2002 and 2010 and elected to the NJCA Hall of Fame in 2009. And I was also associated with TJC with 8 national championships under the tutelage of John Peterson, who's a great mentor, friend of mine, and very thankful for that. For those of you that don't know much about UR tennis, let me play something that will help explain it.
UR Tennis is an advocacy group for underrepresented tennis participants. These participants would include players, parents, coaches, and the learners of all racial minorities, all social class minorities, all sexual minorities, all age-related minorities, and anyone who seems to have been forgotten. Our mission is to act as the voice for tennis. We are striving to bring forth programs, contests, issues, news, education, and philanthropy that will benefit all in tennis. We are seeking active participation from populations that believe they have an interest in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We want to expand our outreach royally, regionally, nationally, and worldly. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to continuously be talked about, and we will pursue this idea relentlessly.
Very good. So I've been on the air nearest I can figure about a year with this show. We have had some very entertaining guests. From top to bottom, those of you that don't normally listen in, I approach this from the ground up. I was at the community college level, which a lot of people would say is the bottom level of college tennis, where you get kids for 2 years. We got the kids that nobody wanted. A lot of people were interested in sending them out to a place like Stanford University. Not many people interested in sending their daughter over to Lee College. We were successful there and brought the idea of that success now into the private world. I now teach tennis here in the Woodlands, Texas, right outside of Houston. I'm very proud of that, and we'll see how things work out in the private world. I can tell you it's not quite the same as it was in college tennis at times, and at others it is exactly the same. And I've been very fortunate to work at FM Tennis Academy in the Woodlands, Texas, a great group of guys that have gotten together and have decided to make a difference in young people's lives, and so we're excited about that. Let me get a quick word in from our sponsors, one of our sponsors, and we'll move on from there.
Hi there. This is Jason Haynes, the Chief Operating Officer of UR Tennis.
I just want to take a second and introduce you to one of our top sponsors, the Nike Tennis Camps. Since 1975, these camps have provided young players with an opportunity to improve their tennis game. They work hard, make new friends, and most importantly, have fun. The Nike Tennis Camps are directed by respected college coaches and tennis professionals. These camps give players a chance to hit thousands of tennis balls and be challenged to play their best tennis. They will get great technical instruction and drilling from great coaches, supervised match play, and a variety of other fun activities. Please visit the Nike Tennis Camps at www.ussportcamps.com or call them at 1-800-NIKE-CAMP and take your game to the next level.
All right, very good. I think we've got Coach John Whitlinger on the line. I'll try to bring him in. Coach Whitlinger, you're there?
Hey, Jason.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
I'm very excited about today. I've had Coach Gould on. I've had John Peterson on. I consider them big people in my tennis life. I haven't had you on yet. You were a big part of gearing me towards being successful in college tennis. We spent some time together out at the Nike Tennis Camps out there at Stanford, and that's where you and I met. I would like for you, though, to there are people out there that have no idea who John Whitlinger is, so can you kind of introduce yourself?
I'm not so sure I know myself either. No, I, I've been coach at Stanford now for 26 years, 18 as an assistant coach under Dick Gould, and this is my finishing up my eighth year as head coach. Before that, I was a head tennis pro at Harper's Point Racquet Club in Cincinnati. And before that, I played on the pro tour for 5.5 years and went to Stanford myself, NCAA singles and doubles champion in 1974, two-time All-American, and had a good junior career. Grew up in Neenah, Wisconsin, and was a junior player in the Midwest, and that's, you know, that was about it. It's been a great run, and tennis has been a great part of my life, and the people you meet, like yourself, Jason, and coming out here to do the tennis camp, and it's been a great life being a tennis coach and in this game for the many years I've been.
And Coach Whitlinger, you have a very modest, humble approach to this as you go through it. Approach is one I quite admire, both, and a lot of people out there do because of the situation you're involved with there at Stanford. In our pursuit here on the show, we are trying to see what's up with college tennis. We're trying to see what's up with American tennis, and you have an interesting perspective on this that a lot of people would like to hear about. So this, how did you get involved with Coach Gould out at Stanford 18 or 26 years ago?
You know, it goes back a lot longer than that. I mean, when I was 16, the National Junior Davis Cup training camp was here at Stanford, and now we're talking about who's who of American tennis back then. Jimmy Connors to Dick Stockton, Brian Gottfried, Sandy Mayer, Harold Solomon, Eddie Dibbs. I mean, we go back to, you know, really to me the glory years. And we came out to Stanford, lived in the dorms, and Dick did a camp, but it was a little bit of a camp, but it was more just basically playing each other and to become part of the Junior Davis Cup team, and that's where I first got, a look at Stanford University and Coach Gould, and then he recruited me to come to Stanford, and which was not a... The difficult thing always out here is getting admitted, and I wasn't sure I was going to get admitted. I had pretty good grades in high school, but you never know out here. And you know, I thought UCLA was probably, that was my second choice, and I thought I might be a Bruin, which is really hard to imagine now after this. But got admitted to Stanford and played on the team for 3 years and turned pro, and then. You know, basically, I was in Cincinnati, and I got a phone call. This would have been probably spring of 1985, and that was the time my nieces were pretty good in tennis too, and I thought Dick was calling me about maybe Tammy and Terry, who may be, you know, calling for Frank Brennan. And but then he threw this curveball at me and asked me to be, or thought if I had any thoughts of being his assistant coach, or, you know, they in college tennis it was just a head coach at that time. Not many people, if any, had assistants, but it was starting to come into play. And Jason, I think you know Coach Gould well enough. He loves to be forefront. He likes to be the innovator of anything. And, you know, if it's scoreboard stadiums, whatever. I mean, things on the iPhones. And, you know, he loves being the first one to do something. And we talked about it. And, you know, he flew me out here again. And it was like a recruiting visit all over again. And I came back to Cincinnati where I was, and we had a pretty nice house in Loveland, Ohio, near the club. And, you know, I told my wife, I said, you know, this, it's intriguing, but I just don't think, you know, I started going around the Cincinnati area and showing her garages. I said, okay, that garage is probably $500,000. And so I said, you know, I'm not so sure. So Dick flew Jan out, my wife, and showed her around and took her over to Fremont and all these places we might be able to get into. And she came back in tears. And I, you know, I said, God, Dick, this probably isn't going to work. And, you know, the one thing about Coach Gould, and again, Jace, you know him a little bit, is that when he says no, he gets into overdrive. He doesn't hear the word no. He doesn't understand what that word means. He, I think no to him means maybe. And so he kept pursuing it, and then I went to Wisconsin and talked to my father, who was basically, you know, my mentor and my coach. And, you know, basically Dad said, you know, why not try it? You might like it. And I thought, okay. He said, you can always go back and be a club pro. You know, Cincinnati would have you back in a second. And he said, why don't you just go out for a year and give it a shot? So I called Dick and said, okay, I'm coming out, and we're going to do it. And, you know, it was a tough transition for my wife, and my kids were 3 and 1 at the time, and lived in a double trailer out in a beautiful place in Portola Valley. But we went from a four bedroom, 2.5 bath, 3/4 acre house to basically a double trailer for about a year and a half. And that's the story. And then, you know, I guess I did like it, because here I am 26 years later. And, you know, a lot of people were wondering, well, why didn't you get a head coaching job, or, you know, why were you assistant for 18 years? And, well, you know what? Like back in the day, the offensive coordinator for San Francisco 49ers is probably the fifth best job in the NFL. And I felt I had the second best job in the United States, working at Stanford, being with Dick Gould, and being with this program. So, you know, I had a couple minor feelers, after a while, but people really knew that this is where my heart was, and it would have had to take a lot of something to get me out of here. And it's been a real great ride, and the people I've dealt with, and the student athletes that I come in contact with daily, and just, this is such a great place to work with all the great sports and the great coaches and the great people that are involved in this university. So that's my story. It's a long one, I apologize, but it's a pretty, pretty good one.
not at all, Coach. You know, I was fortunate to have a young man named Patrick Sullivan. He's the coach of Stephen F. Austin. He holds the record. He took 37 minutes to introduce himself, so you're short-winded there.
Yeah, it's the one thing I talk about my dad, and he was my mentor and my coach, and just an incredible guy, and he passed away yesterday. So I'm on this call with a heavy heart a little bit. I'm going back to Wisconsin Friday, and going to have to miss practice for, you know, our NCAA prep, but I got to give a little talk at the memorial next Tuesday. So 98 years old, it was a pretty good run for him.
Yeah, well, I'm very sorry to hear that. As I said at my 99-year-old grandmother's funeral, you have nothing to cry about. That woman led a wonderful life. You should admire what they did, and they got to see
absolutely.
A lot, do a lot. Back when she was born, there was no such thing as a car, and this was back in the 90s. So,
exactly.
It's something to think about.
No, it is amazing, and, you know, it's funny because, you know, like I said, the guy – you know, you can watch our matches on the internet. So, I mean, this is even a couple of years ago. He'd be watching our matches, and I'd call him after the match, and he'd start critiquing my number one player and my number three player. Why is he doing that? The guy, he was coaching all the way to the end, and it was, you know, he'll be missed, but I know he's looking down on us and smiling.
Yeah, you bet. You bet, Coach. You know, I wholeheartedly agree with you that you have the greatest job in American collegiate tennis. And I interviewed Manny Diaz, but I would consider him second in that line of great American jobs. And only because I've had the fortunate experience of being out there at Stanford, I get it. I mean, I understand why that place attracts such good players. So just, and I don't normally do this, but I am curious if you could name drop the players that you've seen in regards to successful American tennis players in the course of your 26 years there at Stanford.
Well, you know, I'll go even back to when I was playing. We had, you know, Roscoe Tanner, Sandy Mayer, Tim Mayotte, Jim Delaney, Patrick Dupre, who's going into the Hall of Fame this year, Patrick McEnroe, Paul Goldstein, Jeff Abrams, Michael Flanagan, KJ Hippensteel. I'm just sort of looking at my wall back here behind me,
yeah,
which has all these All-American. You know, Alex O'Brien, guy from Amarillo who just, you know, triple crown winner in 92. Bob and Mike Bryan, who were just a joy to coach here. Jeff Salzenstein, Scott Lipsky, who's doing well on the pro tour right now. David Wheaton, who's being inducted in the Collegiate Hall of Fame this year again. Jim Thomas, who had a great run in doubles as a pro. David Martin, who just retired from playing on the tour in doubles. Jonathan Stark, Vimal Patel, Alex Kim, an NCAA champion. Sam Warber, Casey Corkery, NCAA champions. Alex Clayton, just one of the greatest kids of all time. Guy was an NCAA semifinalist. And right now, Bradley Klon, who's a 2010 NCAA singles winner, and he and Ryan Thatcher were doubles finalists last year. I mean, you got to pinch yourself a little bit. And like I said, these guys were wonderful young men, friends for a lifetime, great student athletes and students, you know, and I will say that. I mean, these guys are great tennis players, they're great people, but they're really good students. You know, my team GPA last quarter was 3.5. Last year, my team GPA for the year was about 3.6. I had four guys with 4.0s this last quarter. And you can't say enough about, you know, one, their tennis ability, but also their ability to do both, you know, a great job on the court and in the classroom. And finally, they're really nice guys and fun to be around.
Well, you know, I counted there, let's see here, probably about 20 to 25 professional tennis players. And let me get this right. You didn't want to leave Stanford. You wanted to be the assistant tennis coach for 18 years. It's quite an accomplishment there to see all of those players.
Yeah, no, it's been incredible, Jason. And, you know, I'm 58 right now, and I know I'm on the downside of my coaching career, but, you know, there's still a lot of fire left in me, and, you know, I don't plan on going anywhere too soon. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun. It's been one of the things, you know, I'm a Midwestern boy, you know, from Neenah, Wisconsin, and I never really, when I went to school here, thought I'd end up in, you know, after college, end up back in California. I thought I'd be in the Midwest, and that's why that club job in Cincinnati or whatever I was going to do, I thought it was going to be in the Midwest. And, you know, one of the reasons a little bit was where it raised my children in the Midwest. You know, you hear all these things about California and all that stuff. But, you know, raising my children in this area and having them be around these great athletes and students, and, you know, it's just it's a great area to live in, and I'm really glad. I'm glad my dad said take a chance, because I did,
yeah.
And it's worked out great. And that's the thing with people, you know, sometimes they don't take those chances, and, you know, you never know. You know, sometimes there's something there for you that you just don't give a chance, and it's a shame, but I'm really glad I did.
Well, I love telling my story about how I ended up out there at Stanford to the people around me. You know, I was at the ITA All-American down in UT Austin, and I had just come out of the men's bathroom, and in walked Dick Gould. And in my mind, I said, Jason, you have to stay here. This may be your only chance to meet this guy, and you better take advantage of it. And I stood there, and I'm not going to tell you how long or what have you, but he came out of that restroom, and I said, hello, my name is Jason Haynes. How do I come to work for you? And he said, Jason, send me your resume, and the rest was history. I spent three great summers there complex, and fabulous time, and I wanted to thank you, and I thank Coach Gould for what it did for me and put me on track to be a college tennis coach.
Yeah, I mean, we're really proud of you. I know Dick is, for sure, and so am I. You've done a great job, Jason. It was really fun having you here. And, you know, it's funny, when I got on the call here, you were doing a little ad for the Nike Tennis Camps. And, you know, again, they are, you know, I've done it for a long time, and we think we do a good job here, but they do a good job around the country. And there are really, you know, great college coaches that do a wonderful job with these kids that come in during the summertime. And, you know, and again, you were part of the staff and part of, it was really fun to have you. You do a great job, and you did a great job. I know the passion you had for teaching and having kids learn. And in camp, sometimes that's a little difficult because, you get some kids that are really eager to be there, and you get some other ones that, you know, you almost feel like you're babysitting. But, you know, you deal with everyone, and hopefully they come away with a positive experience. And I'd say probably 95% do, and we're really happy about that.
Yeah, you bet, Coach. Now, listen, I've got a little short tennis interview here. I compare it to Inside the Actor's Studio, but it's more like a tennis. It's a fun interview. The first question is eight questions altogether. The first one is when and who introduced you to the sport of tennis?
My dad, you know, came back. He worked for Kimberly Clark Corporation and brought me back a tennis racket on one of the trips. And, you know, he would be the one that would have introduced me to tennis.
Yeah.
I can go further. I mean, it sort of came. My brother, who was a very good basketball player, he's 9 years older than I am. He very good in basketball and football. And you know, back then, you know, we're talking early 60s, you know, everybody wanted to get as many letters as possible on their letter jacket. So, he didn't have a spring sport, so he was trying to figure out what to do. And the basketball and football coach was a tennis coach. And then my brother decided to play tennis. And then my dad got interested. Then my sister got interested in tennis, and then I came along. And so basically it was my father, and through my brother, basically, because, you know, if my brother started running track or something, I don't know what I'd be doing. But anyway, I can still remember that racket, my dad. And, you know, and then I was involved in the public parks in the Neenah area, and we all had teams. There were a bunch of parks, and everybody had a team. It was a great system, and they used to have, if you didn't have a racket, they could provide rackets for you. And it was probably the first metal racket ever. I mean, again, now we're talking mid-60s. It was metal racket, but it had metal strings. And it was the craziest racket I've ever seen.
Wow.
So if you think about having metal strings, that was not great for tennis balls back then.
So not at all. Oh, wow.
But it was great, so. I was seven. I was seven. I'd go out and play with my mother, who had no idea how to score. But you know, I'm not sure I knew how to score either. But I made her feel good, and that she beat me, and she cooked me a nice dinner. But I can still remember her going out to court number one at Doty Park in Neenah, Wisconsin.
Humvee. Now, is there a phrase or a concept from an early instructor that has stuck with you all this time?
Well, again, the instructor would be my father. And, you know, he had a bunch of them. You know, the harder you work, the luckier you get. I mean, this is probably some of what I'm going to be going over here next Tuesday at his memorial. You know, he would put signs on my bulletin board in my room and, you know, put a tiger in your tank. This is that's another longer story, which I won't get into. But, you know, another saying, you know, when you're not practicing, someone else is. You know, just little thing. I mean, the guy was such a good motivator, he was he and John Wooden were about 4 years apart, and they really never knew each other that well. But, you know, my dad was sort of a disciple of John Wooden, and they finally did get to meet when they were both in their 90s, and it was really something special. But, you know, just little things that my dad would come up with, and those were probably, you know, some of the highlights and, you know, things I'll never forget and very true.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this is a little different. What is your greatest tennis player accomplishment?
Well, there are probably two. Probably the NCAA championship in 1974, singles and doubles. But going back to my junior days, you know, I came out here. They used to have the National Hard Court in Burlingame, you know, right down the road here, about 20 minutes down the road from Stanford. And, you know, big national event, and everybody played it. And I happened to win that event. And then the very next week, everybody flew back to Louisville to play in the National Clay Court. And I won that event. And that's not easy to do when you're playing on a hard, fast court out here and then turn around and play on clay the next week. Not, you know, it's not something, you know, again, you look at the pros, it's not an easy thing to do. And I you know, back then you just, you know, you're playing tournaments, playing matches. It really... Hey, you won a couple national events in a row, which is very neat and cool. But, you know, as I got older and started understanding court surfaces and said, you know, that clay is this way and hard courts are this way and it's not easy to do both, I thought, well, God, you know, I did that back in 71 or 70 or whatever it was. And I thought, you know, that's probably a pretty darn good accomplishment. So, you know, those two were probably, you know, besides getting an opportunity to play Jimmy Connors multiple times, playing Bjorn Borg, playing Guillermo Vilas, Ilya Stasi, you know, some of Rod Laver, Ken Rosewell, some of the great players, which was, you know, didn't have a lot of success against, but just playing them was something else.
You know, you often catch people that say we're in the best generation of tennis. These guys are hitting the ball harder. They are stronger, they're faster, but I tell you what, any accomplishment like that where you have to go through the emotions and the mental that you have to go through to do what you just said proves to me that it doesn't matter what generation it is. Tennis has always been the hardest sport there is.
You know, it's not easy. You know, and I taught PE classes out here when I was assistant coach in tennis, and it was, you know, it's really fun. And you know, you have these brilliant people coming out. As you know, I taught a beginning tennis class and an intermediate, an advanced, and a tournament tennis class. And you know, the tournament tennis class was sort of like a JV team. The beginners were beginners, and I would always say, you know, this is not an easy game. and I meant it, and it isn't, and it's tough, and you know, the pros make it look so darn easy, and again, you get out there, and you know, Jason, it can be a very humbling sport, and you know, you might be good in one thing, but you know, maybe hitting that moving tennis ball, you know, and in this day and age too, the way they are playing, it is a different game than when I played. I mean, we had the wood rackets, and technology has come on. The equipment is incredible, and just the hell, we never stretched back in the day. We never really did much training back in the day. I mean, you think about doing that now, and you know, guys were smoking before, you know, outside locker room, or even inside locker rooms before they would go out and play. It's like, wow, okay. But nowadays, it really is an incredibly, you know, they're such good athletes playing tennis right now. It's scary.
Yeah. Coach, what do you love about coaching tennis?
Just, you know, just trying to figure out the right buttons to push, what can make a player better, because everybody's a little different, and the challenge of, you know, trying to figure out what each guy needs and what you need to tell them, and some things that make sense to other, some guys don't make sense to other guys, and you got to figure out, but just the challenges of making players better, you know, what does it take, and trying to figure that puzzle out. And, you know, it can be, and it can take a while. And sometimes you just say, you know, just off the top of your head, some, you think just stupid, random, dumb thought, but it clicks. And, yeah, you know, it's just that challenge. It's just so fun and exciting, and keeps you going. And just, you know, you just, that's why we're coaches. We want to make each player as good as they can be.
I agree. Is there a concept or a phrase that you've developed in your 26 years here as a college coach that you find yourself using over and over again?
Put the ball on the court. it basically comes down to, you know, preparation and hard work. And if you prepare well and you're ready to go, but you know, if you shortchange yourself in preparation and think that, you know, it's, you can be ready to play a match. I mean, it's being prepared. And that's what my dad instilled in me. I mean, you got to be prepared, and we hope we do that out here, and that we're a prepared team when we hit the court. And you know, sometimes it doesn't look like it, but you know, a lot of times it does. But you know, you just, you know, I want to make sure the guys have done everything they needed to do to be successful at the match they're playing in, or successful students, or successful after they're done playing tennis. I mean, that's a big thing.
You bet. Now, I know you're a huge sports fan. I know that you love watching finals, whether it be the Super Bowl, the World Series. But I have to ask, is there a tennis tournament where you clear out the living room at the Whitlinger household and you order special food and you say, hey, don't interrupt me, we're watching the final of this event?
Well, it would be Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times U.S. Open's on when the start of the National Football League, and I'm a big football fan, so that I go back and forth and TiVo the U.S. Open final sometimes. But, you know, again, you say I am a sports fan, and I'm a big Green Bay Packer football fan, so, you know, if there's a conflict, you know, on that day, you know where I'm going. But, you know, it's funny, Wimbledon, we used to have some parties and things back in Cincinnati, and yeah, it's funny. One time we were watching Wimbledon when my kids were, you know, when JJ and Claire were smaller, and my wife said, you know, Daddy played there, and they, you know, my kids looked at her as like she was like an alien. Said, no way did my dad play at Wimbledon. And I said, yeah. So they looked at me and like, really? I said, yeah. So I think they got a lot more respect for me at that point. Or they still think I'm kidding. I don't know. But it's, you know, it'd be Wimbledon with the strawberries and cream. And just, you know, we used to have a nice little thing going on in Cincinnati. It was fun.
Very good. Now, do you have an all-time favorite tennis player?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to say Pancho Gonzalez was a guy that I sort of followed when I was starting to play the game, and he was just a really tough competitor, and, you know, he had some ups and downs on the court, and, I didn't want to act like him a lot of times, but I just liked the way he played, and he was smooth, and he was good, and, you know, I back in the day when I was growing up, it would be Pancho Gonzalez. As a player, when I was on the tour, I loved watching and playing against Jimmy Connors. I just loved the fire and just everything he brought to the game. Again, he was a little crazy and said some things I wouldn't really want said. But, you know, I love the way he competed, and both those guys. And then today, I just you know, I think Djokovic has done a great job, but I really like Nadal and Federer. I think they're just such class, you know, and so is Djokovic. But, you know, those two guys are really classy, the way they play and how they handle things, the wins and the losses, and they just seem, I've never met them personally, but they just seem like really good guys and have been great ambassadors for the sport. So those are the three parts of my life, the three or four players that, you know, I've really looked up to.
You bet. All right, last question here. Now, this is maybe the toughest one. What is your all-time favorite tennis racket?
Spalding World Open.
The Spalding World Open?
Spalding World Open. This was the racket I won.
You're putting yourself on the spot here. I mean, Spalding, yeah, as a racket company doesn't even exist anymore.
I know. But you had, my favorite one was the Spalding World Open. I mean, I won the NCAAs with it. It was an unbelievably great feeling wood racket. And, you know, a lot of pictures. I mean, I see some pictures they have, you know, in the Hall of Fame over at Stanford, and they got me using a Wilson Jack Kramer or a Wilson Stan, so I can, and one has even a Spalding Smasher. But I have the Spalding World Open in my living room under a glass table, and it's under that, and you can see, and then the one I used to win the NCAAs is in the Hall of Fame in Athens, Georgia. So that's going to be the racket, and it's, you know, this was a wooden racket, and, you know, the thing about wooden rackets, you had to put presses on them, and, you know, this is before the days of racket bags and things like that, so you'd be walking through airports with six rackets with presses on it. You can't imagine how far your arm is out carrying these rackets. But that's it. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. It's a Spalding World Open. Great racket. And it's funny about rackets, you know, back when Prince first came out, I was on the tour at the time, and I really felt, you know, the oversized of the 110 was coming out. It was like that green one. It was, and I really felt that they were going to put specs on tennis rackets. And so I never went that way. In fact, I went to use a Snowert racket for a while, which actually was a smaller head than a normal. I mean, I look at that racket now, and it's like, it's a squash racket. It looks like a squash racket. And but finally, after I figured out that they weren't going to put any specs on the dimensions of rackets, and I went to a midsize and never used the 110, but went to 95s and things like that. But those rackets have come a long way, that's for sure. Spalding World Open, don't forget it.
That's a first on this show where we've had Spalding even mentioned, even as a tennis ball or anything. I will not forget that, that's for sure.
You won't forget that.
No, not at all. Let me remind our callers, if you want to call in and talk to Coach Whitling or myself, you can call in at 714-583-6853. Coach, we're going to get into the meat of this this show here. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about diversity here. And I've had this discussion a lot on the show. There are a lot of Americans out there that feel like internationals don't deserve a place in college tennis. There are coaches that feel internationals do deserve a place in tennis. I noticed out of the 25 players you mentioned earlier, not really one international name on that list. How is it, first let's just say, how is it that Stanford attracts the great American names in tennis?
Well, the tradition and history is just, you know, a big part of it. And these kids, you know, want to be challenged academically and athletically. And, it, you know, you look at all the Olympians and, you know, the pro baseball players. And, you know, it's just Stanford does a great job combining, you know, athletics with a great academic program. It's getting tougher now because of online schooling and internet schooling that a lot of the, you know, the very good young junior American players are doing to, you know, get those players into Stanford because they're not quite doing what Stanford admissions wants to see. I mean, they're doing this online schooling that is, you know, we know why they're doing it, so they could play tennis more, and they're not really taking education very seriously. Some are, but a lot aren't. You know, back again, talking through almost the mid to late 90s, you know, all these kids went to high school, and now it's, you know, these kids are doing a lot of different things. So, you know, again, the way we attract them is just, you know, what the beautiful stadium that Coach Gould fundraised for and built back in the 90s, and their traditions of all the great players that have played here and gone out to the pros. And then besides that, after tennis is done, if you can have a Stanford degree in your back pocket, that's a pretty good deal. So, you know, that's how we, you know, we attract them. And, you know, and it doesn't matter if it's, you know, yes, we have mainly American players here, but, you know, if there's an international player that has the academics and is a very good tennis player, you know, I'm not opposed to having, you know, those international players on our team. I think they bring a lot to the table. The diversity is good. And, you know, I have a young man from Ireland on the team this year, and a young man who played Jordan Davis Cup a couple of weeks ago from Jordan, and I'm having a player come in from Poland next year. So it's, you know, it's always a tricky issue with this international debate, because, you know, there's some good things and there's some bad things. I think the good things, the quality of play in college tennis is incredible. And, you know, the bad news is, you know, does it take some opportunities away from Americans? Yeah, you'd have to say yes to that. But, you know, it's not going to change. And, you know, like I said, these international players and young men are quality people. They're good guys, and a lot of them are getting their degree. And I think the biggest thing is, you know, fundraising in the future, you know, will they donate back to the program? Because, you know, the Americans, there's an attachment, a tie to their university. Once the international player leaves, is that tie still going to be there? Will they donate back money? Time will tell on that. I think it's still too early to tell. But I think that's my only fear. But, again, I've 65% are international. You look at the, you know, the All-American Tournament or the NCAA's coming up, and in the individual, it'll probably be 65 international, 35% American. And, you know, again, some people really look at that and they don't like that. But, you know, personally, I think it's a little skewed. But, you know, again, they've been very good for the game as far as the quality of game. And tennis is a global thing. That's the difference when I played back in the day. I mean, you know, yeah, you had the Australians, the guys from Great Britain, but now it's everywhere, and that's the way college tennis is too.
Well, you're in the what I consider one of the, if not the toughest conferences in America. Now you're gone to the Pac-12. You had your inaugural team event this last weekend. Is that right?
That's right.
I'm going to bet you did see about 65% internationals out there. Now, that international level of tennis that you see in the Pac-12 is quite a bit different than I saw at the community college level. But those international players that I recruited and that you had, it's in my mind, tend to bring a lot to the table to the college tennis team. Are you getting that same impression at your level?
Oh, I absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, again, these guys, they work hard. They're, again, the ones I've dealt with, I sense from other coaches too, their feelings on it. And, you know, most of the coaches, if not all the coaches, say, you know, the international player is respectful, they work hard, and they're thankful to be given the opportunity to be at a great university, whichever one it is. And and I've felt that way, you know, also the guys that I've coached here, which haven't been a lot. But, you know, I just, I've known a lot after they've graduated, and they have gone on and done tremendous things either in this country or, you know, in their home country. And, you know, it's worked out well, and you know, like I said, it's just I wish we could get the Americans involved a little more. But you know, if coaches need to compete, this is the way they got to compete. And that's the way they feel, at least.
Well, in my experience, I see a big problem with American coaching, not American recruiting. And I just hear me out here a little bit. In a directional school A down here in Texas, a coach will say, there's no way I can compete with Stanford. Those guys get the great American players, so I have to go recruit international players. And I wholeheartedly disagree with that. And what I mean by that is that coach has hit the eject button on developing an American tennis player at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They're not
mm-hmm.
going to spend the time on the court to develop that player. They believe I can be a used car salesman here. I can sell this directional university, and I can build a team that way. Being at the top school, do you think – that we need more American development?
Absolutely. And that's the trick right now. Well, you know, what's the best way to do it? And that's what sort of Patrick McEnroe's job is right now. But, I wholeheartedly agree with you on that, you know, bailing out and not working with the Americans and getting them to a level that they can compete with the bigger schools, and it's too bad. It's, you know, you see some of these younger Americans that are eager and willing, and they might not be the best player coming in as a freshman. You work with them, you can get them pretty good pretty quick. And I agree with you on that, and I think they're, unfortunately, a lot don't agree with us on that, and they're going the other way.
Well, I tell you, at Lee, I took I had to have seven American players on my team, and these were girls that nobody wanted. I was in a town that nobody wanted to come to, and we had a 96% transfer rate to Division I schools when we developed these players. I am with you on the fact you do not need to go get all of these international players. I am with you that you need to develop American players. The problem has become time. I just don't think that they realize how much time they actually do have to develop, and they're so into instant gratification.
Right. That's true.
And
that's true.
I think,
and you know, and I don't know, you know, excuse, you know, I don't know how much pressure schools are putting on coaches to compete at a high level. If coaches are worried about job security, that they, you know, they got to do that. Again, I've never felt that here at Stanford, and it's the only place I've ever been. And Stanford is usually very patient with their coaches, and rarely do they let someone go, you know, because of record. And rarely. I mean, I can probably count on one, two fingers, if that may have been the case here, over 26 years. But other places, you know, if they're getting a lot of pressure from an AD that, you know, hey, like, you got to turn this thing around, they don't have a lot of time. They don't have a lot of time to develop, and they got to go out and get someone, like, you know, as soon as possible.
No, I agree. Let me ask you this, and I'm going to skip around here just a little bit. I got to ask this question, and then I'm going to come back and ask a college question. But since you deal with the top level a male player, and I want to say, before I do this question, you know, and I said this to Coach Diaz as well, you know, your two colleges, Georgia and Stanford, are right now responsible for the U.S. having a majority of its success at the Davis Cup level. You know, with
right.
Brian and with John Isner, the last time when we played Switzerland, you got to understand that without college tennis, American tennis is barely floating in that group whatsoever. So thank you for that. But now as we look at this directional thing with American tennis, where do you see it going?
Let me
help you out a little bit, okay?
Okay.
Go ahead.
I just think we're still floundering a little bit. I think the USTA is come back to where college tennis is viable, and it should be. You look at Isner and the Bryans and some of the other college players that are going out, and we can go to Benjamin Becker. Who else can I put out there? I mean, there have been some pretty good pros that have gone to college. I think the USTA is starting to push that again, which is good. But, I think for a while they weren't, and it was really confusing kids, and it was too bad. I go back to my era where we, talking about the Junior Davis Cup camp here, I mean, we played match after match after match, and then we traveled all summer together playing match after match after match against all the best, played against the best, 8 weeks in the summer, a couple weeks before that, played the National Indoor, played the Orange Bowl, played the Easter Bowl. We didn't go over everywhere and who knows where. And you look at that era of American tennis, and that was really a big time in tennis. If you go back to the late 60s, early 70s, through the 70s, even into the McEnroe early 80s. And, I see a lot of junior players just trying, they duck playing tournaments, they stay out of their own division, they, go to India to play an event instead of maybe staying in America or, close by and playing their peers. I think these guys just aren't playing each other enough, and they're worried about, their ranking, and they should be worried about just getting better and improving. And I know in other countries there's like a team feel. I still don't think we have a team feel over here as far as working, the juniors working together. It may be getting better. I don't know. I know it doesn't have to mean that everybody's your best friend, but you respect each other and you work with each other and you try to get each other better. And I wish that would come out a little more in American junior tennis, which I just don't quite feel yet.
I completely agree with that. The last great American team of players that we had, Sampras, Agassi, Chang, Courier, that group, I know there were others in that group. I leave them out. I believe Martin Blackman was in there. But that group of players, like you said, played each other, worked with each other. They didn't necessarily like each other, but they realized that together we could accomplish a lot more than individually.
Right. No, that's true. Now, I wish it would somehow get back to that, but I don't sense that getting well real soon yet.
Well, let me share with you something that I think would dramatically help this, and you got to hear me out. Remember, I come from the bottom level here. The NJCAA 4 weeks ago passed legislation that limits roster spots for internationals. You can only have two internationals on your roster now. The other seven spots are all Americans. Now, in junior college tennis, we're the only ones to be gender equitable in regards to scholarships. We now give 3 fulls and 6 partials on both the men and the women. So we are, in essence, able at that level to create that team-type atmosphere for American players. Now, if you look at it statistically, the decline of American tennis actually started when the decline of the community college system started itself, when we started to see systems vanish. And it's the same. It's not just junior college. It is the same collegiately. When collegiate systems started to vanish itself, the American professional tennis has started to dwindle, where we only get little bits here and there, and instead of large groups of people. And what I get from that, coaches, is that the competition for that scholarship at your level no longer exists, because if I don't make it to Stanford as a freshman, used to, I might have a chance if I went to a junior college. Now, it was a slight chance, and I know this in talking to you and Coach Gould, but I still had a chance. Now, the other major schools in the U.S., you have a better chance of going there. Say, like the University of Texas, they've been known, or Baylor, been known to take a junior college transfer. But that's good enough, isn't it? I mean, shouldn't you go 2 years and develop and maybe consider playing at a place like Baylor instead of just sitting on your tush and being a regular student?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not a bad thing. You know, it's funny, you talk about, I mean, the JC rules now are, you know, what they passed. And, you know, we tried to do something like that in the NCAA years ago. And people were worried about lawsuits and things like that. But, they were talking about having, you know, so many scholarships for an international player, like a 1.5, and then the rest to, the American kids. But I think Division II did it. But it's really interesting that it is out there now. But I doubt it'll ever change. But, I totally agree with you. It would. It's something that it'd be nice to get to it in my lifetime. I doubt it ever will.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I have one other issue with American tennis, and you're not going to like this because I know you on this one. I don't think there are enough one-handed backhands being taught.
You know, I have a two-hander. You know, it just depends on the guy. I mean, I think all two-handers secretly would love to be a one-handed player. You know, I tried on the tour. You know, I didn't like where my two-hander was going for a while. And I decided, okay, I'm going to try to change to a one-hander. Once the rally started, it was fine. The biggest problem I was having was return to serve, you know, where I could only chip the ball. But now guys are bigger, stronger. They're great athletes than me. They can come over the return and things like that. But, one-handers are such pretty players, and us two-handers are just grinders, you know. Is that where you're going with this?
Well, let me throw out a couple of names for you here, and let me see if you can agree with this. Rod Laver, Billie Jean King, Martina Navratilova, Steffi Graf, Pete Sampras, Stefan Edberg, Boris Becker, John McEnroe, some guy named Federer, all sustained themselves on the number one spot for a long period of time, whereas two-handers tend to be kind of flashes in the pan. Now, hear me out. I understand Connors, Borg, Everett, Agassi, all very successful. But when you go up against the longevity of that one-handed player, I gotta go with the one-handed backhand coach.
Yeah, you know, that list you provided is pretty impressive, isn't it? And one-handed players, I mean, Federer in there. I don't know if you added him or he was in there or not, but you throw him in there too. And it's funny. My son, who's my volunteer assistant coach and works at a club here in the area. I was recruiting, this player. I'm not going to say what I was, he's not a big kid, but he's got a one-handed backhand. And my son says, you know, his coaches did him a disservice because, you know, at his size, probably a two-hander would be better. And, JJ might have a point on that, you know, depending on the size that you are. I mean, tennis players now, unfortunately, they're not 5'8" anymore like I am, and it's become a over 6-foot sport. And again, the guys that size, you know, one-handers are like I said. Balotelli came out years ago too and said that two-handers were a thing of the past, and things were going to go like to a 1.5 backhand or a one-handed backhand, and that never quite hit home. The two-handers here to stay, and it can be. You know, I'm going to have two players on my team next year that are two hands, forehand, and backhand. How's that,
Coach? Coach, that's something else. Now, listen, I'm going to lose some of my live viewers here in about 60 seconds, but I got to have one more question to ask you before we get away, and I want to talk about just what we finished what we're on, but I wanted to let my live listeners know I'm going to lose you, and you can podcast this and find out what we talked about. But listen, the one-handed backhand, it's got to be the most dominant shot in tennis because it's the only punch that's outlawed in boxing. I mean, you could kill somebody with a one-handed backhand.
Well,
they don't allow
okay.
that punch.
I guess, and you can with a two-hander?
Well, you know, in boxing, it would look to you know, to use two hands in the boxing, coach. But I'm just saying that you know, that years ago, they realized the power behind that thing and what it would entail.
And
there's something about it. I just let me say that when you think about those players that you mentioned, and I tried a two-hander for about 3 weeks, and I couldn't do it. I just decided it wasn't my thing. But those players tend to stand alone on their own. You know what I mean? Those one-handed players that I named. And that's not to say that there aren't great two-handed players, but those players really have left a mark.
Yeah, no question. You know, it's an interesting thought, that's for sure. And you know, you really have to take each player and see what is best for them and what works. I think you know, a lot of guys come in here and you know, they're two hands forever, and you know, it, as a coaching decision, when I get them, it's really too late to make that move. This move's got to be done.
Yeah.
A lot sooner. You know, I'm not rarely do I get a guy who's playing two hands and think, okay, we better try a one-hander. I have done it, but it's usually done, like Sampras was done fairly early. A lot, you know, guys like that, people like that have done it early. So, you know, I get them when they're pretty much solidified in their games, pretty much. There's still a lot of work to do, but in their basic game, they're solidified.
Yes, sir. Last question for today, Coach, and I thought this was important when I sent it to you. How has the Stanford University experience influence the American college system in a positive, and then if you can look at it maybe in a negative way? And I know that's hard for you, but if you can answer that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at the negative way, and I don't, you know, it's that's really, I can't quite come up with one, you know, the experience out here. I guess if there were a negative way, and what people would say that, you know, how can you have great tennis players and also have great students? That, you know, and I think that's how sometimes people negatively recruit against us, saying, you know, the school is too hard, school this and that, you know, and which is totally not true after what I told you earlier in the show about, you know, our GPAs and 4.0s and, you know, Elite 88 winners who, you know, are, but, you know, in a positive way, you know, it's just a wonderful place to coach. It's a wonderful place to play in. The stadium's great. Just the vibrant atmosphere of this university, as far as college tennis goes, just the traditions, and you know, you look back at the great players that you know, have played here, which I've named, and you know, you got to put it on one gentleman too, who's done a great job as far as, you know, the American college tennis experience, and we gotta plug Coach Dick Gould on this one. And as for all he's done for college tennis and what a proponent he is for all that's good about college tennis. And Jace, I know you know him, you know, without a guy like Dick Gould, like a Dan McGill, like a David Benjamin, you know, who knows where college tennis would be? I mean, I'm leaving, you know, a lot of people out, but you know, I think those, you know, Coach McGill, Coach Gould, and you know, David Benjamin, just have meant so much to the college tennis experience, and we've been very fortunate to have Coach Gould out here and still have him out here as tennis director, and you know, he's in his 70s now, but he's still going strong, and we're fortunate to have him, and college tennis was fortunate to have him, you know, and still have him for as long as they've had, because he really loves the game, loves college tennis, and his record speaks for itself.
Now, Coach, can you duplicate the Stanford experience at a high academic institution? Do you think that you could reproduce that at a different place? I mean, not just you. I just mean in general.
I don't see why not. You know, it wasn't going anywhere here. All it takes is one or two recruits to say, I'm going to wherever.
Yeah.
And that was Roscoe Tanner back in the day. When Dick Gould got Roscoe Tanner to go here, it opened up floodgates. So it's convincing that one player, who then can convince other players, and then all of a sudden things start rolling. I mean, this started here with Roscoe Tanner. Then it went to Sandy Mayer. Then it went to myself and Pat Dupre, Nick Saviano, to Matt Mitchell. To, you know, it keeps going. You could duplicate that other places, but you gotta have something you believe in. You gotta be able to sell your program. It wouldn't be easy, but you gotta get that one guy, and once you get that one guy, you can get that second guy. So it is possible, for sure.
Well, Coach, I really appreciate you coming on the air. I know that you're a busy guy. If someone out there wants to get in touch with you through email, website, or telephone, how would they go about doing that?
Well, they can, you know, I can give out my office phone, I guess, which is 650-725-5648. And my email is jtw614@aol.com.
And let me say also to you and to my listeners, having worked with you, and I had the fortunate experience of working with your son, JJ, out there at Stanford, and I remember him crying one day after he lost a junior in one of our junior little matches out there. But what I remember in particular was that his dad was there to pick him up. And if I know that you're an outstanding representative of your family, and I know you're going through a tough time, and I want to wish you the best. And it was an honor to be around you out there and see you at work. You're truly an inspiration.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, it's funny. I lost my dad yesterday, but my son's going to have his first child in late June. So I'll be a grandfather, which is really scary. But, you know, JJ's come a long way, and I'm really proud of him. I'm proud of my daughter, Claire, who's doing a PhD at the University of Michigan in sociology.
Oh, my gosh.
And she's the brains of the family. And, you know, my wife and I have been married over 30 years. And, you know, it's life is good.
Yeah, I know it is for you, Coach, and I was glad to have you on today. Have a great week and a great run at this NCAA title. I wish you the best of luck.
Thanks. Yeah, the draw comes out at 2:30 today, so we get to see where we start and what happens. So we're looking forward to that. Jason, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, sir. Have a great one.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Yes, sir. Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. That's Coach John Whitlinger. He is a favorite guest of mine that I've had on the show. He is an outstanding gentleman, and he works hard at his job. He loves his job, and it's a reflection of that place that, as he said, Coach Gould created out there at Stanford. It is an outstanding tennis experience, and I would always suggest that you get your sons or daughters that are in tennis involved in trying to pursue that dream. That place is a wonderful place. So much to talk about. And I want to remind you that on next week's show, we have Coach Neil Kinlan. He is another good friend of mine. Neil actually was Division II and Division I coach, and we'll have some great stories to talk about with Neil. That's next Tuesday afternoon, 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock Central Standard Time here on Diversity in College Tennis. And we want to say thanks for everybody that listened in today and look forward to seeing you next week. Come back and listen to us or go to iTunes and podcast us under UR Tennis. Thanks so much and have a great day. Bye-bye.